In the opening centuries of the Neolithic age, the original Aryan speakers and the original Semitic speakers were probably living, so to speak, in different worlds, with a minimum of intercourse. Racially, it would seem, they had a remote common origin. Both Aryan speakers and Semites are classed as Caucasians, but while the original Aryan speakers seem to have been of Nordic race, the original Semites were rather of the Mediterranean type. Fourth, philologists speak with less unanimity of a third group of languages, the Hamitic, which some declare to be distinct from and others allied to the Semitic. The weight of opinion inclines now towards the idea of some primordial connection of these two groups. The Hamitic group is certainly a much wider and more various language group than the Semitic or the Aryan, and the Semitic tongues are more of a family, have more of a common likeness than the Aryan. The Semitic languages may have arisen as some specialized proto-Hamitic group, just as the birds arose from a special group of reptiles. It's a tempting speculation, but one for which there's really no basis of justifying fact, to suppose that the rude primordial ancestor group of the Aryan tongues branched off from the proto-Hamitic speech forms at some still earlier date than the separation and specialization of Semitic. The Hamitic speakers today, like the Semitic speakers, are mainly of the Mediterranean Caucasian race. Among the Hamitic languages are the ancient Egyptian and Coptic, the Berber languages of the mountain people of North Africa, the masked Tuaregs, and other such peoples, and what are called the Ethiopic group of African languages in eastern Africa, including the speech of the Galas and the Somalis. The general grouping of these various tongues suggests that they originated over some great area to the west, as the primitive Semitic may have arisen to the east of the Red Sea Divide. That divide was probably much more effective in Pleistocene times. The sea extended across to the west of the Isthmus of Suez, and a great part of Lower Egypt was underwater. Long before the dawn of history, however, Asia and Africa had joined at Suez, and these two language systems were in contact in that region, and if Asia and Africa were separated then at Suez, they may, on the other hand, have been joined by way of Arabia and Abyssinia. These Hamitic languages may have radiated from a center on the African coast of the Mediterranean, and they may have extended over the then existing land connections very widely into Western Europe. All these three great groups of languages, it may be noted, the Aryan, Semitic, and Hamitic, have one feature in common, which they don't share with any other language, and that is grammatical gender. But whether that has much weight as evidence of a remote common origin of Aryan, Semitic, and Hamitic is a question for the philologist rather than for the general student. It doesn't affect the clear evidence of a very long and very ancient prehistoric separation of the speakers of these three diverse groups of tongues. The bulk of the Semitic and Hamitic-speaking peoples are put by ethnologists with the Aryans among the Caucasian group of races. They are white. The Semitic and Nordic races have a much more distinctive physiognomy. They seem, like their characteristic languages, to be more marked and specialized than the Hamitic-speaking peoples. Fifth, across to the northeast of the Aryan and Semitic areas, there must once have spread a further distinct language system, which is now represented by a group of languages known as the Turanian, or Ural-Altaic group. This includes the Lappish of Lapland, and the Samoyed speech of Siberia, the Finnish language, Magyar, Turkish or Tatar, Manchu and Mongol. It has not, as a group, been so exhaustively studied by European philologists, and there is insufficient evidence yet whether it does or does not include the Korean and Japanese languages. H.B. Hulbert has issued a comparative grammar of Korean and certain of the Dravidian languages of India to demonstrate the close affinity he finds between them. Sixth, A fifth region of language formation was Southeastern Asia, where there still prevails a group of languages consisting of monosyllables without any inflections, in which the tone used in uttering a word determines its meaning. This may be called the Chinese or monosyllabic group, and it includes Chinese, Burmese, Siamese, and Tibetan. The difference between any of these Chinese tongues and the more Western languages is profound. In the Pekingese form of Chinese, there are only about 420 primary monosyllables, and consequently each of these has to do duty for a great number of things, and the different meanings are indicated either by the context or by saying the word in a distinctive tone. The relations of these words to each other are expressed by quite different methods from the Aryan methods. Chinese grammar is a thing different in nature from English grammar. It's a separate and different invention. Many writers declare that there's no Chinese grammar at all, and that's true if we mean by grammar anything in the European sense of inflections and concords. Consequently, any such thing as a literal translation from Chinese into English is an impossibility. The very method of the thought is different. Their philosophy remains still largely a sealed book to the European on this account, and vice versa, because of the different nature of the expressions. Seventh. In addition, the following other great language families are distinguished by the philologist. All the American Indian languages, which vary widely among themselves, are separable from any Old World group. Here we may lump them together, not so much as a family as a miscellany. There's one great group of languages in Africa, from a little way north of the equator to its southern extremity, the Bantu, and in addition a complex of other languages across the center of the continent about which we won't trouble here. There are also two probably separate groups, the Dravidian in South India and the Malay-Polynesian stretched over Polynesia, and also now including Indian tongues. Now it seems reasonable to conclude from these fundamental differences that about the time when men were beginning to form rather larger communities than the family tribe, when they were beginning to tell each other long stories and argue and exchange ideas, human beings were distributed about the world in a number of areas which communicated very little with each other. They were separated by oceans, seas, thick forests, deserts, or mountains from one another. There may have been, in that remote time, it may be 15,000 years ago or more, Aryan, Semitic, Hamitic, Turanian, American, and Chinese-speaking tribes and families wandering over their several areas of hunting and pasture, all at very much the same stage of culture, and each developing its linguistic instrument in its own way. Probably each of these original tribes wasn't more numerous altogether than the Indians in Hudson Bay Territory today. Systematic agriculture was barely beginning then, and until agriculture made a denser population possible, men may have been almost as rare as the great apes have always been. If agriculture was becoming at all important in human life at that time, and if population was anywhere denser, it was probably in the Mediterranean region, and possibly in areas now submerged. In addition to these Neolithic tribes, there must have been various still more primitive forest folks in Africa and in India. Central Africa, from the Upper Nile, was then a vast forest, impenetrable to ordinary human life, a forest of which the Congo forests of today are the last shrunken remains. Possibly the spread of men of a race higher than primitive Australoids into the East Indies and the development of the languages of the Malay-Polynesian type came later in time than the origination of these other language groups. The language divisions of the philologists do tally, it's manifest, in a broad sort of way, with the main race classes of the ethnologist, and they carry out the same idea of age-long separations between great divisions of mankind. In the glacial age, ice, or at least a climate too severe for the free spreading of peoples, extended from the North Pole into Central Europe and across Russia and Siberia to the great tablelands of Central Asia.